This is Bradcast producer Desi Doyen. We're off this week. Today's Bradcast was originally recorded on May
13th, 2025.
The committee will come to order. The chair. The chair will advise the audience that disruption of a congressional business is a violation of law and is a criminal offense.
Really? Since when? Only when they peacefully protest against Medicaid cuts? I pardon them.
I don't know why I came here tonight.
You're welcome.
I got the feeling there's something right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am from Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles. This is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA and on dozens and dozens of other fine affiliate stations on both the airwaves and the internets around the country and the world. Blanketing planet Earth, I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today for another thrilling edition of the Bradcast. All right, Desi Doyen,
yes,
hi, how are you?
I'm okay.
You will have our latest Green News report a little bit later on today's show. With some remarkable news about plans to shut down FEMA, Trump's firing of its director just before hurricane season.
All kinds of fun stuff.
It'll be fine. And a new plan in Texas to require solar plants to produce electricity at night.
Bingo.
I wish that was the punchline of a joke, but it ain't. Anyway, I've got a guest standing by that I want to get right to on top of all of that, on an issue that really, really needs our focus today, I think. While Donald Trump has been, as usual, sucking up most of the nation's media attention with his economy-crushing tariff and trade war, his pretend deals with UK, his caving to China in hopes of saving face and saving Christmas, his wildly corrupt effort to accept a $400 million flying palace from the royal family of Qatar to use as Air Force One and then as his own personal parting gift after leaving the White House, if he ever leaves, his administration's almost certainly unlawful gutting of the federal government and science and medical research and university grants and public education and the rule of law, his almost certainly unlawful and unconstitutional deportation policies, his defiance of the federal courts, the public arrests of judges and mayors by his masked FBI, Homeland Security, and ICE goons, and so much more that keeps all of us off balance every day as he floods the zone with childish, corrupt nonsense, the bulk of which is likely to be rolled back eventually anyway by the federal court system, at least hopefully. While Donald Trump is doing what he does best, freaking out the nation with insane tweets and bad policy ideas and unconstitutional executive orders sucking up the media and the public's attention to them, the slim Republican majorities in both the U.S. House and Senate, while all of that is going on, those slim majorities are trying to come to consensus on what is now being called Donald Trump's one big, beautiful bill to encompass his entire second term agenda into one massive piece of legislation that will cut hundreds of billions, if not trillions, in public services in order to help pay for the extension of massive tax cuts, most of which will go to millionaires, billionaires, and wealthy corporations, which, having originally adopted those cuts in his 2017 tax legislation, well, those cuts would otherwise expire at the end of this year, all while reportedly increasing the national deficit by trillions of dollars, despite Republicans' decades-long claims to be outraged by increases to deficit spending. There is still much unknown about what the final bill, if one ever comes up for a vote, will actually look like, as Republican factions battle among themselves with what suffices for moderate Republicans in purple or blue districts attempting to avoid some of the deepest cuts to programs like Medicaid, while far-right lawmakers in presumably safer districts are vowing to block any budget bill, big, beautiful, or otherwise, that includes increases to the national debt. Of course, even if GOP lawmakers do come to some form of consensus in the House, they will have to do the same thing over in the Senate. And then Republicans in both chambers will need to agree to one single version of that big, beautiful bill that can pass with a majority vote in each chamber. A simple majority vote in each chamber. Presuming Senate Republicans stick to so-called reconciliation rules in the upper chamber, which limit the type of legislation that can pass under those rules, such a bill could avoid the need to overcome a filibuster with a 60-vote margin in the Senate and pass with just the barest of majorities there as well as in the House. Over in the House, the margins are even thinner for Republicans, who can afford to lose just 3 votes. From their majority in order to pass any of this legislation. But as Trump's actual agenda is tied up into all of it, well, they are hoping to get it done and get it done as quickly as possible and even before the Memorial Day recess coming up at the end of this month in the House. And while the nation is otherwise distracted day by day, hour by hour by Donald Trump's lunacy, Republican House members are compiling what budget expert Bobby Kogan of the Center for American Progress describes as what would be, if adopted, quote, the largest transfer of wealth from the poor to the rich in a single law in U.S. history. On Monday, he detailed in a post last night, House Republicans unveiled the final parts of their partisan tax and budget bill. Their proposal, explains Kogan, would dramatically reshape America for the worse. It would implement the largest cuts to both Medicaid and the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP, what we used to call food stamps, in history, kicking millions of Americans off their health insurance and taking away food from hungry children. It would raise household electricity costs while trapping most middle class and poor students in greater student loan debt to afford a higher education, and it would make all of these changes as a means to partially offset tax breaks that disproportionately go to the richest Americans, giving households in the top 0.1% a multi-hundred-thousand-dollar tax break on average, while increasing deficits by trillions of dollars. Taken as a whole, he says the bill would add trillions of dollars to structural deficits despite these enormous cuts to critical services. Joining us now to drill down into this mess that is really, really easy to get distracted from is Bobby Kogan. He's the Senior Director of Federal Budget Policy at the American Center for American Progress. Before joining the center, he served in the Biden-Harris White House as advisor to the Director of the Office of Management and Budget, where he assisted with the American Rescue Plan and the Inflation Reduction Act. And prior to that, he served as chief mathematician, didn't know that was a thing, but apparently it is, and as the head of budget analysis for the U.S. Senate Budget Committee under Senators Patty Murray and Bernie Sanders. Oh, Bobby Kogan, welcome, sir, to the broadcast. Thanks for joining us. And by the way, and thank you for making sense of this mountain of Republican legislation in such short order since it was finally unveiled just on Monday.
Brad, thank you so much for having me on.
So as noted, much of this could change in the days and weeks and maybe months ahead, depending on whether House Speaker Mike Johnson can wrangle his caucus in the House and Majority Leader John Thune can do the same over in the Senate. But the biggest cuts to government services to pay for a Republican tax cut in the GOP House proposal includes some $600 billion in cuts to Medicaid and to the Children's Health Insurance Program, or CHIP, the largest cuts in history. Didn't Donald Trump campaign on a promise to not touch Medicaid along with Medicare and Social Security?
Yeah, you know, at times he said he wasn't going to touch Social Security. He frequently said he wasn't going to touch Social Security or Medicaid or Medicare. And at times he said, I'm not going to touch Medicaid either. And allegedly he had meetings with House Republicans asking them to tamp back on their Medicaid cuts. And what we saw was the complete opposite. What we saw was them calling for the largest Medicaid cuts of all time by far, right? By hundreds of billions of dollars. That honor, you can't see me, but I have heavy quotes going on. currently, Ronald Reagan, big surprise, did the largest Medicaid cuts ever. And we'll have to, right now we only have preliminary estimates, but these will probably be after you kind of adjust for population and time and money and everything, on an apples to apples basis, be twice as large as Reagan's cuts and maybe more, right? So we're talking huge, huge cuts to Medicaid that would kick millions of people off their health insurance and condemn many thousands of people to die each year who wouldn't have otherwise died.
Well, that's what I was going to get at. So we are talking about millions of Americans who could lose health insurance coverage here, whether it's via Medicaid or the CHIP program.
Yeah, that's right. So CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, is does budget and economic analysis for Congress. They're the kind of neutral arbiter and referee and research group for Congress. And they have only done preliminary estimates. So we'll get more. The numbers will be refined in the next week or so. But their preliminary estimate is that the Medicaid and CHIP provisions would kick 7.6 million people off their health insurance.
Yikes. And I'm going to go back and forth here between some of the actual, you know, details and the politics surrounding it. But I mentioned that those House Republicans many of them are facing very difficult reelection prospects next year. They're in purple or blue districts. They claim to oppose cuts that would take away health care from, you know, tens of thousands of their own constituents. But given this proposal, that I guess is now going through markup, should we assume that those Republicans have given up that fight? Because it's going to affect a lot of their own constituents, no?
Yeah, it absolutely would really, really, really hurt the people who they claim to represent and serve. It's unclear whether they've given up, whether they are hoping that they, you know, it has to pass the House first and then it has to pass the Senate and then it'll have to go back to the House. So it's unclear if they're voting yes and hoping that it dies in the Senate or what's going on. But I guess what I would say is even the so-called moderates, right? Like Don Bacon is one of the alleged moderates. And he said, well, I won't accept Medicaid cuts above $500 billion. Now, of course, they actually walked out of there with more than $500 billion, but even $500 billion would be the biggest Medicaid cuts of all time in U.S. history. So I guess I would just say they maybe talk a good game, but they are all ready to cut Medicaid. And I guess what I would say is, you know, in 2017, when Donald Trump was the first time, he had a slim trifecta, right? He controlled the House and the Senate. And there, in their ACA repeal bill, they were trying to do the largest Medicaid cuts of all time in U.S. history. They failed then, and now this is their next trifecta, and they're trying again. So they might pretend that they don't want to cut Medicaid, but you know, their actions show that they are actually laser-focused on cutting Medicaid.
Which is interesting, because on the other side of the aisle, from the moderates, you also have the folks on the sort of the hard right, the Steve Bannon right, the Josh Hawley, Senator Josh Hawley from Missouri on the right. He's also trying to warn Congress off of these deep cuts to Medicaid. So I'm wondering why he's doing that. And, you know, so you've got folks on the right and the left saying, of the Republican caucus there, saying don't cut Medicaid, and yet they're doing it anyway. I mean, I guess the question is, you know, can this stand? Are they all going to sort of say, okay, we're against it, but we're going to do it anyway?
Yeah, we will see. I mean, as you mentioned, they're doing markup for Energy and Commerce, which is the committee that oversees Medicaid. They are busy. The members of that committee are going through the bills, seeing if they want to amend it or whatever, their portion of the text, and assuming they vote it out, we will be before the Budget Committee and then the Rules Committee and then the full chamber within the next week or two. Now, what happened in 2017 was they made it through committee markup with very little problem, and then they got stuck before the full chamber for months. They waited, and then they eventually tried in March of 2017, and then they pulled the bill, and Paul Ryan gave a speech where he looked very unhappy and said, Obamacare is the law of the land. And he looked really, really upset that he couldn't kick millions of people off their health insurance. And then it took them 2 months before they actually passed the bill out of the House, and then it eventually languished in the Senate. So TBD on this. If it follows the same pattern, then we will see energy and commerce and ag and ways and means successfully mark up today and tomorrow, and then it might languish in the House for a bit.
It's got a long way to go. Republicans and the White House have been claiming that much of the savings from Medicaid is going to come from new work requirements for those who receive Medicaid and from more frequent checks for eligibility of recipients. I guess it's they want to do it twice annually instead of just once a year to determine eligibility and so forth. Will any of that actually save money for Medicaid, as they're claiming?
It will, but it'll save money by kicking people off of their Medicaid. It's not about stopping fraud. The hyper majority of what they are proposing in Medicaid cannot credibly be construed as going after fraud. Instead, what they are doing is they are saying they're transforming Medicaid from a lifeline for folks into something you only get if you meet certain conditions. So it'll save money because if you lose your job, let's say the economy enters recession and you lose your job, well, now you no longer get your Medicaid. So that saves money for the federal government, but it saves money because you lost your Medicaid. Right. And I just want to say the states that have implemented these work requirements have led to disaster, because it's not actually something that leads to more work. In fact, the studies show that it doesn't increase total amount of work. Instead, what it does is it puts up so much red tape that folks fail to make it through the cracks. They end up disenrolling even tons of people who are working just because they can't make it through the red tape. So that saves tons of money to the state, or to the federal government, but it saves tons of money because people have lost their Medicaid.
Right. Which ultimately doesn't necessarily save the government money, because then they, you know, show up at emergency rooms and so forth seeking care. Much of these cuts, Bobby Kogan, that I understand it, will be to also to states that expanded Medicaid through the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare, where if states had opted in, as I think most have now, it's about 40 something states who have opted into that. Am I right about that, Bobby?
Yeah, that's right. I think it's 41 or 42 plus DC. Anyway, it's in the low 40s.
And so if they opted into that, then the federal government would pick up 90% of the bill for those expanded Medicaid patients. The states would pick up the remaining 10%. But if I'm understanding this correctly, a big portion of these proposed cuts would thereafter require states to pick up what the federal government will no longer cover, that they're shifting the costs to the state on some of this. Am I understanding that correctly? And if so, can states afford to do that, to pay for what the federal government no longer will? And will that somehow prevent millions of Americans from losing access to health care because, oh, the states will pick it up, so it'll be fine. We don't have to count those as people who are losing their health care.
Yeah, so there are two nasty things that they're doing to the expansion population. One, they are, so what you're talking about, that 90%, 10% share, for this ACA expansion population, states pay 10%, federal government pays 90%. They would lower that from 90% to 80% if the states on their own dollars help any undocumented folks. So states say, okay, well, people are going to show up in the emergency room anyway. We may as well do better care, you know, whatever, right? Like, we may as well do this anyway. And it's also the humane thing to do, because regardless of where you're born, you still don't deserve to get sick and die.
Hang on, wait. You're saying that if people who are undocumented show up at the emergency room and they are helped?
No, sorry, I wasn't clear. I was talking about why states might actively choose to provide Medicaid to those populations.
Right.
But at any rate, so if the states provide help to those populations, then the federal government would kick it down from 90% to 80%. And that takes away money from not just the undocumented folks, but from everyone in the expansion population. So that pulls back a lot of money. That also then automatically, some states have what are known as trigger laws, where if it drops from 90%, then they automatically disenroll every single person in the expansion population. So all of a sudden, what we're running into is a lot less money for states. So that's one way in which they're kind of hurting that population. Another thing that they're doing. Oh, sorry. Go on.
And it's one way that they can say, "Oh, we're not cutting those people. They can still have Medicaid. We're just only going to pay 80%." But then the states end up cutting them because they drop their program. But the federal government can say, "Oh, we didn't do that."
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, they'll claim we didn't do that. We just gave you less money to cover the people. But you know, take away funding to cover people, then it means worse health outcomes, right? It means fewer people covered and higher costs and that sort of stuff. And then the other thing that they're doing to those folks is they're forcing for people who make above 100% of the poverty line, which is still very, very, very low, right? We're talking maybe 15K a year or something. Mm-hmm. But for folks who are making above 100% of the poverty line, but on Medicaid, this would force states to impose cost sharing, right? Out-of-pocket costs, co-pays, that sort of stuff, on that population. Now, states could do a small amount. So you might expect blue states to maybe do a dollar or something for a service, but other states can impose as much as a 5% of your income. So let's say you make 15 grand, state that wanted to do this could impose $750 of out-of-pocket costs for you to use your Medicaid, which now makes the Medicaid unusable to you. Right. And so now they've gotten a lot of savings because the person didn't use the Medicaid. Right. They got a lot of savings, but they did it by effectively making it unaffordable for the population it's supposed to serve.
Well, that'll show you sick, poor people. Not to be sick or poor, I guess. let's talk about the proposed cuts also in this bill to SNAP, formerly known as the Food Stamp Program, nutrition assistance that currently helps around 1 in 8 Americans, which is a lot of people. Although they receive just over $2 per person per meal in this program, which I guess some Republicans like to describe as waste, fraud and abuse. So they're hoping to lower that number from just $2 per person per meal to something lower than that.
Well, yeah. So as you point out, SNAP benefits are incredibly meager. $2 per person per meal is not much money.
No.
Under an initial version of this, they were looking to cut that down to $1.67. That didn't actually make it into this version, which is great. Instead, they did very hefty work requirements, even heftier than already exist. And they also created, for the first time in SNAP, a state share model where they will push costs onto states. And it's not clear what happens if the states decide they can't afford afford that. So on the first one, the work requirements. For work requirements, normally if the economy is bad enough, you can get a waiver, but they are saying they are making it so that waiver only applies if the unemployment rate is above 10%. And to put that into context, you take the Great Recession. There was 1 month in the Great Recession where the unemployment rate hit 10%. Oh, okay. Besides that, it was below, right. So you're basically making it where if you have other than an economic collapse, you still don't get this at all. And they're also, so the work requirements for SNAP is for what are called the ABODs, the able-bodied without dependents. Mm-hmm. And it used to be where that meant if you were, you know, kind of prime working age and didn't have any kids, any kids below the age of 18. Well, they changed that to kids below the age of 7. So you have a 7-year-old. Now, all of a sudden, you're no longer considered to have a dependent. And so all of a sudden, they're taking food away from you and your 7-year-old if you lose your job. Right. It's like deeply evil stuff.
It really is. It's twisted. It's immoral. And the idea that in both of these programs, Medicaid and SNAP, let's just push it over to the states. Let's make them do it. States have far less money. They often have balanced budget requirements and so forth, unlike the federal government. So, if you just push off the costs to the states, it doesn't make them go away. Those costs still have to be paid or the services are lost. You write in your piece at CAP that, quote, the plan also proposes to block future administrations' ability to implement benefit adjustments. How can they prevent future changes by a different administration under a different Congress? I don't get it.
Yeah, so the president has the authority to do to make adjustments to what's called the Thrifty Food Plan, which is how the SNAP benefits are calculated. And so Biden in his administration did a unilateral change to boost benefits about 25% to account for the fact that what is considered a healthy diet and the cost of that has kind of outpaced the normal SNAP benefits. So people had, in reality, for keeping up with a healthy diet, had fallen further and further and further behind. So SNAP, so Biden did in a boost that drove Republicans apoplectic. And so they wanted to limit the ability to do that ever again.
I see. Take away that power from the president to do that in the future.
Yeah, God forbid the president further update it as if it ever falls behind again.
Good God. Very quickly, I want to just hit a few more of the key points here. Energy costs, the big, beautiful GOP House plan would also increase energy costs for Americans. How so?
Yeah, so there were a lot of provisions of the Inflation Reduction Act that were targeted towards making helping people go green and lower, get some electric or some solar or wind energy and helping lower their household costs. Yep. And their plan would undo basically almost everything that exists, that still exists in the IRA, where there's any money left over, any ongoing tax credits, are trying to undo it. And so the effect is any of the households that would have benefited from having lower energy costs, they are no longer going to be able to get that.
And I've heard from folks, from our listeners, who have said, under that program, I was able to get a heat pump. I was able to get solar in my house, have it all covered by the federal program, by the Inflation Reduction Act. That would go away. How about the subsidies for fossil fuel companies? Will those also go away? Or are the Republicans once again picking winners and losers here like they pretend that no one else should do?
Yeah, you will not be shocked to hear that they are not getting rid of the fossil fuel subsidies.
What?
Yeah, no, truly, truly, truly shocking.
Unbelievable. And then we get to education costs. Not just energy costs are going to increase, but also increase the cost of education for students?
Yeah, that's right. So they would do about $350 billion is the preliminary CBO estimate, about $350 billion of cuts to student loans. About $200-ish billion of that is ending the Biden SAVE plan, which never really went online. Mm-hmm. So that's a cut relative to what people ought to have gotten, but it's been tied up in courts. But the remaining, $150 billion is all cuts relative to what people are receiving and feeling now. It's just higher costs for borrowers. It's making college more unaffordable. Now, it's changing it into, basically, it would transform student loans to look more like a mortgage, pushing a lot of them into 30-year terms. Right now, if you, in the traditional plan, you pay for 10 years, they would make that be 10 to 25. And in the income-based plan, you pay based on your income. And if you paid for 20 years, you get the rest of it forgiven. And if you're a graduate student, you pay for 25, you get the rest forgiven because you have paid for long enough. But they would change that to be 30 years and they'd change the traditional to be 10 to 25. They would also they would end up increasing the net present value of any of the payments that any individual makes. So this is all a long way of saying it just makes college less affordable for kids. And at the same time, they would kind of make it more difficult for Pell recipients. Pell is the program where if you're extremely poor, then we help you attend college. And they would make it so students have to take tougher course loads in order to get their Pell.
Unbelievable. So, and all of this And this is really, I guess, the key point. All of these stolen services, as I see it, stolen services from Americans that Americans paid for health, for food, for education, for energy. You explain all of this would allow the GOP to give millionaires a $68,000 tax cut and households in the top 0.1% a $300,000 tax cut. These are the people who obviously need these tax cuts the least, and to pay it to them, you take it away from that 7-year-old who's getting $2 a day, $2 per meal per day. I mean, does any of this do anything tax-wise for the rest of us who aren't the millionaires or in the 0.1%? He promised Donald Trump promised to kill tax on tips during the campaign. Is that going to happen?
So the tax on tips is in there for a few years, and shocker, they have done it in a way that will allow for gaming of the system for plenty of folks. So they didn't even do like a smart version of no tax on tips. So they have a temporary no tax on tips in there. But the answer, you take it all together, and the answer is that they do the average tax. But we'll have to see. We haven't gotten the new tables yet for what they've released, but yeah. For the just extending the expiring Trump tax cuts, the average benefit to the average household is about $1,000. Whereas, as you said, the benefit to the millionaires is over 68,000. The yep. benefit to the top 0.1% is over 300,000. So they give a small amount to many households as a way to try to kind of bring people in when, as you say, it's just an excuse to really do a giant handout to the rich. Right. And so they might do a little bit more here or there. But even with that little bit more here or there, they also bumped up the parts to the rich. So they further increased the estate tax. They did a bigger carve out that goes to hedge funds and private equity and C corporations. S corporations. Mm-hmm. And then they created, and I'm not making this up, a special new way for people to avoid paying capital gains, right? It'll make it so that, it's so funny. They have this basically a grant program through the tax code that is intended to funnel money to religious schools and homeschools and private schools without any consideration for quality at all. And inside of the way that they create this in the tax code, they created a tax avoidance scheme for capital gain. So now all of a sudden, Elon Musk and the Waltons and everyone can get away with some of their cap gains.
Unbelievable. But, well, maybe not unbelievable. I guess we knew it was coming. The biggest question at this point, I'm looking at this and I'm wondering if any of this can actually pass both houses, even though Republicans only need a bare majority vote in each chamber. But if you listen to the different factions of the GOP, they sort of seem to be miles apart, but they have come together before when it seemed like they couldn't come together. They just end up capitulating. Donald Trump gives them a call, threatens them on Twitter or whatever. Are you expecting Bobby Kogan that they will get this done? And if so, do you have any sense of how long this will actually take? Or, I'm sort of looking from the outside thinking, well, could they really blow this and not get anything passed before we go into another election year next year?
Well, I certainly hope that they fail. This would be a profoundly evil bill that would leave millions and millions of Americans worse off and leave thousands of people dead who would otherwise not be dead. So I certainly hope this fails. I'd rather be in their position than my position. That is to say, I think it's more likely than not that it succeeds. As you say, even though many of them are pretty uncomfortable, it just takes one call from Donald Trump saying, do this or else I'm going to make sure you lose your job. But this is actually raises a question, right? So when Democrats were doing the ACA in 2008 and then part two in 2009, a lot of them voted for it knowing that that would be the end of their careers, but they were willing to do it because it was going to give, 20 million people health insurance. Will Republicans be willing to lose their career in pursuit of like ripping health insurance away from folks, ripping food away from 8-year-old kids. I really hope not. I really hope that they're not able to do it. One potential outcome is where this bill falls apart, and then you get to December, and then Republicans just put up a clean TCJA extension and say, okay, Democrats, take it or leave it. And another thing is where they could spin off, right? So we talked about kind of all the social services cuts inside of this. There's a whole other part of this bill that's dedicated to boosting defense spending, boosting spending for ICE, and boosting spending for like the Coast Guard and that sort of stuff. So inside of this, as Donald Trump is like rounding people up and illegally disappearing them overseas, he wants to more than double ICE funding. And it's possible Republicans will split that off. That was the original approach, the two-bill approach. And so it's possible we might see that two-bill approach revive if they can't figure out what to do in this one bill.
Well, listen, if you really, really want to cut money from the federal budget, that's where the money is over there in defense. That's where it's pretty easy to cut pretty deeply. But no, instead, they're talking about increasing that. Bobby, I really got to get out. I do hope to talk to you, to keep talking to you as this goes forward, because you're really helpful on this. But as someone who has worked in the White House and in the Senate, in about 15 seconds, is there anything that our listeners can do to help fight back against this in the weeks ahead?
Sure. The number one most important thing you can do is attend a town hall and speak directly to your Republican member, if they're willing to hold a town hall. There is nothing more important than talking face to face with your member. You can also talk to your Republican governor and have your governor call your member, because that is a meaningful interaction. And then finally, you can call the office.
Senior Director of Federal Budget Policy at the Center for American Progress, Bobby Cogan, formerly a budget advisor in the Biden-Harris White House and on the U.S. Senate Budget Committee. You can find his work at AmericanProgress.org. I will link to his piece with many more details about this immoral Republican budget proposal. But you can read it at AmericanProgress.org, and you can find him on the Blue Skies at BB Cogan. Bobby, really appreciate you joining us today, sir. Hope to talk to you in the near future.
Brad, thank you so much for having me on.
You bet. Okay, let's get to a quick break. It ran a little longer than planned. But
I think there's some deeply evil stuff, just like you guys said. No kidding.
Evil and, frankly, immoral. So
yes.
I want to make sure people understand it, which, you know, is, of course, it's immoral, because that's why Republicans seem to need to claim to be Christian so much, because they wouldn't, if they actually did have moral Christian values, they wouldn't have to tell you how often, so often that they are Christians. They would just act like it. They would just act Christ-like.
Very true.
This ain't it. All right, quick break, and we're back with kind of a creepy story out of the courts that I want to touch base with. Also, Green News Report a little bit later. I'm Brad Friedman. You are listening to the Bradcast.
What the public hears on the public airwaves matters. At the Bradcast, we do our best to bring you accurate news and analysis on the issues that actually matter, and we do it all independently without corporate or political influence. But we can't do it without you, now more than ever. Please help us stay on your public airwaves by going to bradblog.com/donate to help keep us going. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Hey, this is Brad. You're listening to an encore presentation of the Bradcast. My thanks again to Bobby Cogan of the Center for American Progress. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from BradBlog.com. As noted, ran a little bit longer there than planned, but hopefully it was helpful. I do want to quickly get to this story from Washington Post over the weekend that I just got a chance to look at today, but I think it's really, really creepy. And you should know about it, be made aware of it if you aren't already. We've been talking, of course, in recent days about the Trump administration arresting, the mayor of Newark over the weekend, falsely claiming that he, quote, stormed a federal immigration detention facility in his city. The Trump administration has arrested a county judge in Milwaukee, claiming that she helped a migrant escape in her escape arrest from her courthouse. Prior to that, Donald Trump has been calling for impeachment of a federal judge who ruled against him on the use of his of the Wartime Alien Enemies Act of 1798 to detain and deport migrants to El Salvador without constitutional due process, resulting in Supreme Court Justice John Roberts making a rare rebuke to put out a public statement that saying essentially we don't impeach judges for decisions that we don't like. That's what the appeals process is for. The fact that Roberts felt it necessary to respond that way should tell us quite a bit, frankly, about what federal judges are dealing with right now. But this story from Washington Post over the weekend suggests it's actually far worse and far creepier than I think most of us appreciate. I know this sounds odd, but as Derek Hawkins reported, federal judges say unsolicited pizza deliveries to jurists' homes that began in February may number in the hundreds across at least seven states, prompting increased security concerns and demands for a Justice Department investigation. Many of the deliveries have gone to judges presiding over lawsuits challenging the Trump administration's policies. The U.S. Marshals Service has supposedly been tracking the deliveries, and judges have been sharing details about their experiences in hopes of finding out more about what they call an ongoing attempt at intimidation, intimidating the judiciary. So, yeah, I mean, it sounds weird, like a, you know, a prank or something, but clearly this is meant to send a menacing message to judges. We know where you live. Some of the pizza deliveries have gone to judges' relatives. In recent weeks, orders have been placed in the name of a U.S. District Judge, Esther Salas's son, who was fatally shot at the family home in New Jersey back in 2020 by an attorney who posed as a delivery person.
Wow. So an unsolicited pizza delivery to her home in the name of her dead son.
Who was murdered. In an interview with the Washington Post, U.S. Circuit Court Judge Michelle Childs, who serves in Washington, said that she received seven anonymous pizza deliveries at her home over the past few months, one shortly after she took part in a ruling against the Trump administration in a lawsuit over the firing of an independent government watchdog. It's unsettling, she says, because I'd like to go to work every day, even with the hardest cases, just feeling like there's no sense of intimidation. Childs is also the president of the Federal Judges Association. She said, it's really an unnecessary and unfortunate threat to our security when we're trying to be judicial officers in a very neutral position with respect to our cases. You need a strong judiciary, she said, for the system to work. This is infringing on democracy. The Marshals Service declined to discuss the deliveries in detail, including the number that judges have reported or how many judges have been targeted to date. In March, the Office of the U.S. Marshals Service for the Southern District of New York sent a memo to some judges in the area mentioning the anonymous pizza deliveries and saying the incidents appeared to be connected to high-profile court cases. Chief Justice John Roberts warned back in December about harassment and threats directed at the federal judiciary in his year-end report, saying threats of violence, disinformation, and defiance of court orders had risen significantly for some reason. As the Trump administration fights more than 200 legal challenges to its policies, Trump and his allies have repeatedly criticized judges who rule against them, at times describing them as radicals. White House spokesperson said in an emailed statement to the Post that attacks against judges and other public officials, quote, have no place in our society. And yet on Sunday, Trump once again criticized what he called, quote, a radicalized and incompetent court system, unquote, which he said was standing in the way of his mass deportation agenda. Judge Childs said the first unsolicited pizza arrived at her house in February, not long after she and another circuit judge rejected a motion by administration lawyers that would have cleared the way for Trump to fire the head of the Office of Special Counsel, the independent agency that protects whistleblowers. She mentioned the experience at a judge's meeting soon afterwards, saying it felt strange. And then she got word a couple weeks later that the marshals were looking into other similar deliveries. In the months that followed, six more pizzas arrived at her house. Some came in early April, she said, right after she had lectured on the rule of law at the National Judicial College and spoke about threats to the judiciary on a National Constitution Center podcast. Judge Salas, the federal judge whose son was murdered, said that she has watched with growing alarm over the past few months as whoever sent the pizzas to judges appears to change tactics. She says it went from judges getting pizzas to then judges' children getting pizzas, to then judges getting pizzas or their children getting pizzas that they didn't order in my murdered son's name, she said. Mm. Her son was 20 when a lawyer who had a case before her fatally shot him at their home. Her husband was critically injured by the same gunman. She said a federal judge handling a case involving the administration was the first to tell her that he had received a pizza in Daniel's name, her son's name. The judge called April 8 as she was preparing a speech that she would make the next day for the opening of a food pantry dedicated to her son. She said it felt like psychological warfare.
Because it is.
She says, we know what all this means, right? We know the first is, I know where you live. The second is, we know where your children live. And the third now is, do you want to end up like Judge Salas? Do you want to end up like her son? In the time since, she said, pizzas have been sent to judges in her son's name in D.C. and at least seven states. So, yeah, this is getting real creepy. Judge Salas said, our leaders, people in position of power with large social platforms need to think about the consequences that may flow from the inflammatory rhetoric that is directed at judges. Lives are very well at stake, she said. And I wonder which people in positions of power with large social platforms that she's referring to. By the way, Elon Musk has also been calling for the impeachment of federal judges after they made rulings that he didn't like. Senator Dick Durbin, the top Democrat on the Judiciary Committee, who last week he called on the Justice Department and the FBI to investigate all of this. Obviously, they should, or frankly, and or should have been doing it already. Are they? Here's the sad part. I don't even know if they will. It's not clear what, if any, role Justice Department headquarters and the FBI have played in investigating the deliveries so far, the Post reports. The FBI referred questions about the matter to the Marshals Service, and Justice Department spokesman didn't respond at all to requests for comment. Paul Redman Michel, a former federal appeals court judge appointed by Ronald Reagan, said the deliveries and other threats highlighted an urgent need for Trump and Attorney General Pam Bondi and other administration officials to make clear that they will follow court orders regardless of the outcome and prioritize judges' safety. He said, quote, we know from the January 6, 2021 rioters that there are people out there who are perfectly prepared to be extremely violent and damaging and threatening, said Michel. Judges have to feel confident enough in being protected, he said, that they can make decisions without looking over their shoulders and worrying about whether their decisions will be unpleasing to the administration, might cause them some kind of harm. And, of course, that seems to me to be exactly the point of this. But it's creepy, and I just wanted you to know that it's happening. I wanted to sort of put that out there because I think it deserves notice right now. What next? Well, what next for us, anyway, is the Green News Report. Let's take a quick break here. On the broadcast, I'm Brad Friedman. Don't touch that dial. Hi, this is Brad. My thanks to those who stopped by bradblog.com/donate to sign up for a subscription to the Bradcast of any amount you like. We rely on you to stay on your public airwaves. Please grab a subscription at bradblog.com/donate. Thank you.
You're listening to an encore presentation of the Bradcast.
Okay, Desi Doyen, break us out of this creepy trance, if you don't mind, with our latest Green News Report.
Is FEMA prepared for the upcoming hurricane season, year-round fire season with a dangerously low disaster relief fund?
That's a good question. Trump administration fires acting FEMA director just weeks before hurricane season begins, one day after that hearing. NOAA says it will stop tracking billion-dollar weather disasters. Plus, Texas legislature moves to require solar plants to provide power at night.
All of that jackassery and more straight ahead from BradBlog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
You need to give constituents what they need when they're facing tragedy.
Well, you came to the wrong administration, Congresswoman DeLauro. This is your Green News Report. I'm gonna soak up the sun. Okay, Desi Doyen, so Texas is going to make the solar plants produce energy at night.
Yes, they are.
Oh, you got to love Texas, your home state.
Yep.
What do you got for us today, Des?
Well, first up, despite the Trump administration's efforts to deny climate change, intense weather events are not letting up.
What?
Extreme rainfall in Somalia's capital, Mogadishu, triggered widespread flash floods that have killed more than a dozen people as we go to air and destroyed homes, roads, and bridges. In Los Angeles, more than two dozen people had to be rescued over the weekend amid a record-breaking heat wave broiling Southern California. In the UK, unusual drought and heat have forced farmers to seek financial assistance for wilted crops. Here in the U.S., AP reports that forest and fire officials in Washington State and Oregon are warning that Trump administration funding cuts to the U.S. Forest Service and the National Park Service are leaving wildland firefighting crews short-staffed, with the peak months of summer wildfire season fast approaching.
Why worry?
And with hurricane season officially starting on June 1st...
Oh, that's why we should worry.
The Trump administration abruptly fired the acting head of the Federal Emergency Management Agency, Cameron Hamilton, just one day after he defended the agency in a congressional hearing for daring to publicly disagree with plans by Donald Trump and Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem to dismantle it.
I do not believe it is in the best interest of the American people to eliminate the Federal Emergency Management Agency.
Okay.
Well, there's the problem right there. He told the truth. What is he doing in the Trump administration?
Well, he's not in the Trump administration
anymore.
Trump's and Noem's plan is for states to bear most of the burden and cost of disaster recovery, as detailed in the right-wing manifesto Project 2025. But emergency management experts warn that state and local governments do not have the funds or the capacity to handle major disasters. That's why FEMA was created. They warn states don't have time now to train new emergency workers before hurricane season. The new acting FEMA chief is a former military contractor with no demonstrated knowledge of emergency management as required by law. The Trump administration also announced that it will stop keeping track of the cost of extreme weather disasters, even as their frequency and economic damages continue to rise. NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, says it will now retire its popular billion-dollar weather disaster database, which documents climate and weather disasters that caused at least $1 billion each in losses. Killing it off will make it more difficult for the public, companies, insurers, and elected officials to keep track of climate damages and efficiently allocate resources. Thanks to that database, we know that billion-dollar disasters are becoming more frequent. Since the 1980s, the U.S. has gone on average from just $3 billion disasters a year to now seeing one every 3 weeks.
But get rid of the database and we get rid of the disasters, right?
Yep. Across the federal government, the Trump administration has been deleting public, taxpayer-funded environmental data and canceling key climate research and resilience programs.
Incredible, or maybe not so incredible.
Finally, in Texas, the state Senate passed a bill last week requiring solar plants to provide power at night. If passed by the Texas House, it would require all renewable projects, even existing ones, to now purchase additional power supplies, largely from coal or gas plants. Solar plants in particular would be forced to buy power that matches their daily output at night, at a time when no one expects them to produce energy. The state's largest business lobby warns the law would increase electricity rates across the board for everyone. As a whole, the legislation cuts against rising support for renewables across the state, including among Texas Republicans.
Texas, it's like a whole other country. I wish. For much more on all of those stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Find, follow, and share us on the social medias, especially Blue Sky at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
That's right, you're not from Texas. That's right, you're not from Texas. That's right, you're not from Texas.
No, they don't. Texas doesn't want you anyway.
That's an old song.
I guess it is.
So, yeah, long ago.
By the way, that story from Texas reminds me of, you know, the old joke. Donald Trump's Space Force, he said he figured out he was going to launch a mission to the sun. But, sir, mission to the sun, you can't do that. He's, oh, yes, I can. I'm a genius. I'm brilliant. We're going to do it at night. That's kind of like what's going on in Texas.
Yes.
By the way, killing FEMA? Before hurricane season or any time seems to me to be absolutely insane.
Yes, it is completely bonkers. And, you know, they can try to dismantle it in all kinds of different sneaky, insidious, perverse ways to make sure that Americans do not get the services that they pay taxes
but
for.
But it doesn't matter. I mean, as soon as a disaster strikes, whether it's a hurricane, a wildfire, a tornado, or whatever, and there is no FEMA to answer the call, seems to me the administration is going to be held accountable for that.
One would hope.
I can't even imagine what they are thinking. Then again, I rarely can. All right, we got to get out. Thanks again to Bobby Kogan of AmericanProgress.org, to my producer Desi Doyen, to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's program or any other, you can download them all for free at bradblog.com. No paywall. Why? Well, thanks to those of you who hit a donate button while you're there. We could really use the support. You can also go straight to bradblog.com/donate. Please consider signing up for a monthly subscription of any amount you can afford. It is all greatly needed. We count on you and only you to stay on your public airwaves to do what we do day in and day out here on the Bradcast. So thanks in advance.
Yes,
drop me
you.
Email if you like. I am bradcast@bradblog.com. And you will find me on the social medias, especially Blue Sky, at the Brad Blog. We'll see you there. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
That's right, you're not from Texas. That's right, you're not from Texas. That's right, you're not from Texas. Texas wants you anyway. Won't you?